welcome to the Bowler Podcast. I'm your host, Tim Miller. We've got some good news about the Minneapolis live shows coming tomorrow. So if you were hoping to get a ticket but it sold out too quick, keep a close eye on your email tonight and tomorrow morning. Go to thebowler.com/events. We are, you know, trying to give people more opportunities. It's an awesome response. We really appreciate y'all. So we'll have some more news on that tomorrow. But you see, tickets went fast. So keep an eye out on thebork.com/events. Also, stick around at the end of this show for a little monologue about a bunch of stuff, but I'm particularly the Texas Senate race, which might end up being my 13th reason why if something doesn't change down there. So I've got some thoughts on that. But first, he's a Minneapolis-based attorney, an anti-ICE activist, a former state legislature candidate, a researcher on housing policy, a social media firebrand. It's Will Stancil. How you doing, man? Welcome to the show.
All right. Glad to be here.
You got a little shiner? What's happening there?
I do. I face planted on the ice. And so I've got half my face is a little swollen up. But that's a normal Minneapolis winter hazard. And of course, we have a different kind of ice that's a bigger hazard here lately. So
we obviously spend most of the show talking about that. But for people who are not social media sickos like me, who maybe aren't familiar with your work product, with your, you know, really the artistic canvas with which you take, you know, short form text-based social media. Tell us a little bit about you, you know, first date stuff. Where did you emerge from? I don't even know. Like, you just kind of like emerged into my vantage point sometime on social media. Like, what's your story?
I mean, I'm a pretty ordinary guy. I live in Minneapolis. I'm an attorney. I work mostly on civil rights and housing law, school policy. And then I've been involved in local politics up here to a reasonable extent. I ran for office, didn't win. I, you know, involved a lot in my neighborhood and my community, and I'm pretty vocal on social media about national politics. I'm no fan of the current administration, the current president. You know, I think that I've got some criticisms of both sides, but you know, ultimately, I would describe myself as primarily someone who's pretty fanatically fixated on the threat posed by Trump and all of his minions. And unfortunately, they have come to us.
You're in a good place. I think people have said the Bulwark's fanatically fixated on Trump and his minions. Why did people start following you on social media? Like, what happened? Did you have a moment? Did you have a breakout tweet that went viral? Or did it all just kind of happen gradually over time?
I think that there's been a few different things. But the main thing, I think, in 2016 to 2020, I was pretty singularly fixated on the idea that Democrats were not doing enough to obstruct Trump, to investigate him, to impeach him, and to hold him accountable after he left office to ensure that he couldn't come back. I have been fairly convinced from day one that Trump is, by all practical considerations, a fascist and a authoritarian, and that all of the people who want to downplay him is, you know, just joking around or you know, Trump being Trump, that's reckless and dangerous, and that he would do any of this stuff if he was given half an opportunity. And I think that, you know, as time passed, that view has unfortunately been somewhat vindicated.
I have some more thoughts about some of your big social media moments of yore, maybe at the end, but obviously we have some more pressing matters.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the reasons I reached out is like people kept seeing you, you know, you were, you're like in the background of these videos of things that are happening on the ground of Minneapolis. And all of us have been kind of watching it with such great interest. You've been part of the reason for that, I guess, is you've been tracking ICE in your 2011 Honda Fit.
It's the best car ever made.
Yeah, talk about that. How did that start? What are you seeing on the ground? Just like paint a little picture for us.
Yeah, so essentially what we have here in Minneapolis is we've developed this extremely dense network of community observers and rapid responders to ICE. And the reason this has happened is because, especially in the early days, and after Renee Good was shot, around when that happened, the way ICE and Border Patrol have conducted themselves here in Minneapolis is hard to even describe to people who weren't here. You would go around the neighborhood and you would see armed, masked men abducting people, tear gassing, you know, major businesses, major commercial intersections, people getting beat up in the street by these folks. They're rolling around, you know, in these armed convoys. It felt like a military occupation. There was a push to figure out what we do about this. I think that the approach that we have landed on, which is partly adopted from tactics that were activists put together in Chicago when ICE was in Chicago, but has been expanded on, is this sort of observer system. All the neighborhoods have, you know, signal chats that are rapid response signal chats, sort of neighborhood specific. Suspected ICE vehicles are reported into there. We have people that are looking at directories of known ICE plates to confirm whether or not they're ICE. we don't know all the places. Sometimes it's ice and we don't know it, you know, and then you also just try and look in the car. I mean, if it's two guys in uniform with masks on, it's, you know, that's confirmed. If we identify an ICE car or ICE agents, you know, a report goes out and we have people doing what we describe, the term we've adopted now. And I think this comes from Minneapolis, I've learned, is commuters. And so what I've been primarily doing is what we call commuting. Commuters are essentially car patrollers. I drive around the neighborhood in my car. I try to look out for ICE vehicles. I call in for plate checks over my phone. And if you know, someone calls in, you know, a report or an observation, I try to get in front of them, get to them really fast. And then we just follow them. The ICE people hate it. They do not like being watched when they work. If they get out of the cars, we film them. We put in the rapid response. People come running. You know, 50 people show up with cameras within a few minutes. Sometimes, not always, sometimes there's an attempt to make some noise to alert people or to draw more observers. So there have been a few instances. For instance, we had a large convoy and I've gotten behind them and just lay on the horn. And then, you know, dozens more people come in. You get, you know, 10 more cars and they just get swarmed and basically followed out of town. It is proven relatively effective, I think, at restraining them, although it has certainly not stopped them. I've seen them abduct a number of neighbors and I've seen them do a lot of terrible stuff, but it's clearly been,
So
been
like, what's the goal? Like what it's effective in doing what? Like if, you know, they don't hassle people as much if they think they're being watched, or like what's the objective?
So I think there's a few different things. I mean, first, the goal is when I have seen them abduct people, for instance, it's hard to even describe the violence of it and the suddenness of it and how shocking it is. This isn't like a police stop where they pull over, they arrest someone, and they put them back in a car. They, you know, they write up everything. They talk to people. You will be driving along, suddenly out of the SUV in front of you, Jeep Wagoneer or whatever, often a Wagoneer. Two masked men jump out. They run someone down on the street. Maybe three more Wagoneers show up, and suddenly there's 20 armed guys on the street. They grab the person. They don't talk to them. There's no attempt to say, "Who are you?" They just grabbed them. They are carried, struggling, into the back of the SUV. And then the doors are gone, shut and they're gone. The whole thing can last 60 seconds. There's no chance to find out who it is. There's no record of it. So if we don't get the person's name before they're in the car, they're just gone. We can't confirm who they are. We can't confirm what happened to them. We can't get them an attorney. We can't confirm if they're a citizen or anything about them. And there's no sense that they know who they're taking. Often it seems like they are lurking until they spot someone on the street who's walking unaccompanied, who's a person of color. The people I've seen being taken were, I think two of them were black and two were Latino. It's shocking. It's like watching an abduction. If you didn't know, if they didn't have uniforms with on it, you think it's a kidnapping.
So you've just seen this just from your driving around. You've seen four of these. That's what you're saying?
I've seen this happen four times. Two of them were ICE cars I was following that suddenly stopped and grabbed someone. One was a military operation. They deployed into an intersection. There were tons of agents. They pepper sprayed a bunch of people. There was almost a riot because of the violence of it. It was a major commercial intersection. One was a car that I was following that I had flagged as ICE or thought was ICE, but had only a moment to confirm. And they suddenly pulled into an alley and chased a man into an alley and grabbed them there. I think I was probably the only witness. And then two of them were 16-year-old teenagers that were taken out of a car. I showed up, you know, after a number of other people showed up, but they were still in the process of taking them. That turned into a massive showdown. There was a crowd. They ended up tear gassing about half the neighborhood, beating up several protesters. The infamous picture of them pepper spraying someone from, you know, 3 inches away on the ground was from that incident.
Got it.
And so this was happening all over the city and all over the region.
Yeah. And so circling back to like, okay. I mean, just almost like to be the devil's advocate, right? Like, mm-hmm. Whatever. Like, so you might think people on the other side would say, well, you guys are creating the problem by following them around. And like, you're not actually really solving anything. Like, mm-hmm. They got the guys anyway. And, you know, this is some whatever white knighting bullshit that's not actually achieving anything. Like, what would be your reaction to that?
You know, they were doing this before many people started doing this. I mean, this appeared to be how they wanted to operate.
Yeah.
It's really difficult to even describe it. But for instance, I've seen many instances where ICE have gotten out of the cars and not really done anything related to immigration. Simply gotten out, brandished weapons, waited for a crowd to gather, and then tear gas a crowd. Bovino would do this frequently. Bovino would roll around in a large convoy, park somewhere, often at a gas station, often a Speedway gas station for some reason. He would sort of wander around in front with his little, you know, platoon of guards around him while the crowd gathered. He would sort of posture. He always had photographers with him, and they would take pictures of him sort of posturing and staring at the crowd. And then he would peel out, and they would just toss some tear gas canisters out the window on the way out, or Bovino would even throw one. He tear gassed a park near me for no particular reason.
Yeah.
When you see them operating, it becomes obvious that there's not any effort here to do this in a, you know, the right way. there's not an effort to do this in a way that is consistent with what we think of as law enforcement. And so what has happened, of course, is that the observers like me have been forced to adopt more aggressive tactics, that we're on them more consistently because they don't give us an opportunity otherwise. If you are not behind them at every minute, they may jump out and grab someone and that person will disappear. And one of the reasons I feel so strongly about this is that when I saw this happen, you know, especially the one I saw that I mentioned was in an alley, you know, I was the only witness. And that was one of the first times I'd seen something like this. And I did not get that guy's name in time. I could have gotten in my car and said, "What's your name? What's your name?" He may not have given it to me. They don't always have the presence of mind because they're being abducted. But sometimes they do. The teenager, I actually managed to get her name. And she was very brave. She was crying and she looked at me and stated her name for the camera. But, you know, this guy, I didn't say it in time. And I remembered as he was being pulled into the car and I went out there and tried to say, "What's your name?" But it was, he was gone. And because of that, we will never know what happened to that man. We don't know who he is. And we don't know what happened to him. And when you see that and that's on your conscience and you realize that, you know, you could have been there a few seconds earlier, you could have gotten his name, you could have gotten help get him a lawyer, you could have figured out, you know, what happened to that man. It's really very, very hard to want to let these guys operate in secret.
The Economist called this, what you guys have been doing, one of the most significant civil disobedience efforts in America since the civil rights movement. And to me, like, I think that the value of it from a distance is like obvious, right? Like we have all of this now first person video of what's happening. People are seeing it. You're seeing the negative reaction. Like even the fucking cowardly Republican senators are starting to get, you know, weak kneed a little bit. And it's in big part because of the images, right? Like that's how you convince people what is real and like what is happening in front of their face. And so I think that there has been some backlash.
So the first purpose is to get the names of the people abducted, to put some restraints on them so they can't operate like secret police. The second goal here is just to make a record for the public, the records that are being made by observers. And it's not just me. I want to be really clear that what I'm doing, many thousands of people are doing. There's nothing special about me. But what people are doing, that record is now filtering into the public and is changing public opinion. And I think that's vital. And it, even getting the press in. I mean, there's been some controversy recently in the local rapid response groups about whether to bring press. And I actually got kicked out of my local rapid response, although there's some others that are strict for bringing press. But getting press in the car, and then they see this happen firsthand on camera.
The view of the not having press in there is because some of the folks want to do it anonymously. They're worried that the government will come for them or something. Is that why they don't want press around?
There's a lot of paranoia, and I would describe in the activist circles that the government will come and you know impose consequences later if they're identified. But the reality is I mean, there's not. I would say it's mostly irrational. We're following ICE in our cars. They have our license plates. And in fact, what they'll do sometimes, it's happened to me twice, is they'll look up your license plate when they're following you, and then they will drive and park in front of your house and tell you, you live here. We're going to arrest you if you keep following us.
They have done that to you?
They've done it to me twice, yeah.
Yeah, I saw another story about somebody who lost their clear. Like, there are some other, and it's hard to, like, kind of verify all this stuff. Like, is that a coincidence? Or this happening?
They remove your TSA pre-check. But the reality is I think everyone who's involved in this understands there is a level of risk. These are violent men. The real risk comes from the fact that they could confront you on the ground, and it would get out of hand, as happened to Alex Brady and Renee Good. You know, they could remove your TSA pre-check, too. I mean, I guess that's fine. I'm not even fancy enough to have TSA pre-check, to be honest. But
you can take your shoes off,
I will live with that. I will live with that for the purposes of protecting my neighbors. I do not believe that they could like legally charge me in a significant way. They have occasionally detained observers like me. I have actually, when they have stopped me in the past, there's been a few times where they stopped me and said, threatened to arrest me. I said, arrest me, do it, you know, and I will figure out in the court because I have a legal right to be here.
What about the fear? I mean, obviously, Alex Preddy and Renee Good were doing some version of this. And so I do wonder what that's like among other activists you talk to. Are folks more afraid? Are there more precautions being taken?
The real risk is that these men are quite violent. They're not well-trained often. They're not well-disciplined, even when they are well-trained. They're heavily armed. There's always the possibility that this could escalate into, and I've seen observers get their windows smashed. I've seen them get pepper sprayed and dragged up, kind of beaten up. And then, of course, in those two instances, they got shot. I mean, in Alex Brady's case, I mean, just brutally executed, you know, shot in the back 10 times. That's the fear. I think that everyone understands that's a risk. You know, I would recommend if you're doing this to take precautions to avoid that. Not to criticize Alex Brady, because obviously who knows what situation he thought he'd end up in. But if I was doing this, I would definitely never take anything that would look like a weapon because it could be used as a rationale. And when you get confronted with ICE agents, you know, don't escalate. You say, I'm not impeding you physically. You say, I have a right to be here. I say, if you want to arrest me, you can arrest me here. but you know, don't do anything that looks like escalation. But with that said, I mean, ultimately, I don't think Rene Goode escalated. I don't think Alex Predi escalated. There is just an element of risk to this, and it's inherent in the effort.
Talk to us about the supposed de-escalation. What's that looks like on the ground? It's kind of hard to see, you know, from a distance and tell. Like, everything is mediated through what's coming in our social media feeds, et cetera. And I saw some reporting from the Minneapolis Star Tribune that, like, about the same number of cars are going out on patrols as were going out before. Obviously, you don't have, like, the little Goebbels, like, running around smoke bombing people. So that's a minor plus, I guess.
Yeah, so the major changes that we've seen have primarily been that you don't see these militarized convoys rolling through with Greg Bovino. There was these really, really aggressive escalatory actions. They almost seemed intended to incite community violence, where he would just roll through and try and cause chaos in the streets. And we haven't seen as much of that. But what we have seen, there's the other side of this, is what I would describe as the secret police side of this. And what we have seen is an increase in these, of stability in the number of these lurking ICE cars that hide in alleys, unmarked cars, agents just sort of rolling through the neighborhood, scoping things out. And we've also seen, I think, at least no change and maybe an increase in the aggressiveness towards observers like myself. And so it's a little confused on the ground what direction we're going.
Well, I think that's because probably the administration's a little bit confused about what direction they're going. So there have been, you know, I think the last really 48 hours, a lot more, you know, sort of social media conversation about some of the more aggressive tactics from protesters, like on the left. Like, we saw they had lit something on fire in the neighborhood and got into a little altercation with somebody. There was this video going on yesterday of people, like, shutting down a street and checking every car's plate that went by. That makes me uncomfortable. Part of what I don't like about ICE is the papers please culture, you know, and so I don't think that our side should be doing papers please either. What's your sense of what's happening, you know, in the protest movement?
Unfortunately, as this has gone on, I think there has been sort of an increase in paranoia among the community responders. For instance, at the beginning of this, I found it relatively easy to bring press on ride-alongs to see this stuff. There's an increasing suspicion of the press. Some of that is just kind of the evolution over time as people have been in this high-stress state for a long time. I think some of it may be that you have more traditional left-wing protest leaders that have, and were not initially not prominent in this at all, have made an effort to sort of step forward and sort of take control of some of these structures. And, you know, to be clear, the vast majority engaged in rapid response are just everyday people. They're not even particularly ideological necessarily. They're certainly not necessarily far left. I mean, it's just moms and dads garsaying watch outside their kid's school, for instance. And so there's been a bit of a clash there. My view of it is that most of this stuff is pretty excessive. I'm not a big fan of putting barricades and checking people's plates. You know, I think that creates fear, just, you know, almost as much as ICE does. Certainly, you know, the other day, that was at the site of Alex Preddy's killing. But, you know, when people were lighting fires, I very strongly objected to that because I was here in 2020 and I saw the risks that, you know, if this spills over into civic unrest. And I think it's very important that what we're doing here, part of why we have such massive buy-in from the community and part of why it's been really effective, is that we are restricting ourselves to things that are legal and constitutional. We are simply driving public roadways. We are observing people's license plates. We are communicating publicly through public channels. We are maintaining lists of suspect plates. We are blowing whistles when we see something fishy. None of that is too dramatic behavior, although when you aggregate it to thousands of people, it's pretty effective. If we start doing things like setting up barricades, we start setting fires, if things get violent, for God's sake, I really think that undercuts our case. And I really hope we can avoid going down that road. And I think by and large, people agree with me. I mean, I think the rank and file of people doing rapid response are, again, they're just ordinary people and they don't want that. But there are certainly, as always, there are some people who are more radical or more aggressive and they want to push us in that direction. And I think that there's some tension here.
Back to the regular folks you were talking about. You mentioned this also on Blue Sky yesterday. There's a bunch of other activism happening that's, like, a little bit off the radar of folks. And I just thought it'd be nice for you to talk about, like, the other things you're seeing from the community as far as community response in Minneapolis.
Yeah. So this gets overlooked. It's not as exciting as following an ICE car in a car chase, which is, you know, getting all the attention. But what is happening, we have thousands of people in hiding here in Minneapolis, you know, not just people who are undocumented. ICE appears to be pretty indiscriminately targeting anyone who's not white. And so many families of color, you know, Black, Latino, are basically afraid to go out in public. They're afraid to send their kids to school. You know, some of our schools are 50, 60, 70% absenteeism. Our school system is more or less in a state of collapse right now. It's akin to COVID. It's a disaster as someone who works in school policy. And what we've seen is that many of these people are basically being supported by their neighbors. So I have friends, you know, and we're talking not particularly political, middle class white moms who are spending all of their time just going to Costco every day, loading up on food and supplies, and then driving down this, you know, to a list of 40 homes that they have and dropping off food for the families every day. There are thousands and thousands of people engaged in this. It's less public, partly because it's just less, you know, it's less glamorous, I guess, but also because these are people who are directly engaging with families who are afraid of being targeted. So no one wants them in the public eye because they have lists of houses and vulnerable families. But they're in some ways, I think, almost the most heroic of all of the people here, because they are, you know, doing this kind of selfless work just to keep their neighbors fed and supported, you know, delivering supplies for the kids, delivering games for the kids, delivering them school materials so they can do at least try to keep up with their schooling.
Yeah.
And this goes back to kind of what you're saying earlier about just the mass appeal. Like, the thing that's been so inspiring about what's happening in Minneapolis, the thing I think that's been so effective about it, like politically, is just like, these sort of just regular acts of kindness, these sorts of defending your neighbors and trying to protect your community, you know, from this masked, like, invading force, like, is something that just resonates with most people who aren't sociopaths, you know? And I think that, like, focusing on that is something that is politically salient in a way that some of the other more tenuous political issues are not, is not.
You know, there are people here who make this into, you know, a movement to push out law enforcement generally, or, you know, even people who want to make it, you know, a democratic thing. What has really made it, like you say, it's made it so given it this mass appeal, is the sense that there's something just offensive about the idea that armed men are going to come into your community and they're going to grab your neighbors and they're going to terrify your neighbors and they're going to keep your neighbors' kids out of school. You know, these are people we live with. Some of them we know, some of them we just see. It doesn't matter. You know, our sense is that our job is to protect our neighbors. And I think that sentiment is it just goes deeper than any political ideology. And people have written about this. This is not an original idea on my part. But what's ironic here is in some ways, it seems that the premise of Stephen Miller and the Trump administration is that we wouldn't feel this way about our immigrant neighbors. You know, we're a different culture than them. We're a different race than them. And so we wouldn't have those bonds of community. And it turns out that not only do we have them, but they're so much more powerful than ICE ever expected.
Yeah, actually, the vice president's made the opposite case, right? That, like, social cohesion is hurt by having, you know, all of these different immigrant communities in the city. And you guys have demonstrated that to be not the case. And it's the vice president that is the one that is trying to be socially discohesive. There's just one element, as you kind of mentioned, COVID 2020, and there's, like, this kind of masking subtext of all this. And it has, like, brought some clarity to me. I got into a little trouble over Christmas break. I was on with Jon Stewart, and we were making some little jokes about people that were still, like, were forever masking. And that created some backlash on social media, as you might imagine. And obviously, I want people to protect themselves if they're sick and protect their neighbors if they're sick. And, you know, obviously. But, like, one of the reasons, I think, why, like, a sort of permanent masking culture is a turnoff for me is that, like, it is unneighborly, right? Like, there's this kind of cultural norm of like communication, of being able to say to your neighbor that, like, you know who I am, I know who you are, we live here together, we care about this community, and we want to help you. And having these masked thugs come in and try to screw with that, I think brings a little clarity to why, you know, maybe some of us were uncomfortable, you know, with some of the arguments around masking. I'm wondering what you make of that.
You know, I'm enough of a libertarian to say that if people want to
mask, should do whatever they want.
Yeah, if they want to mask, they can mask. I mean, if it makes them feel safer, that's fine. I will say that, you know, personally, I don't really wear a mask ever. I'm not overly worried that ICE will identify me, you know, and I, you know, sure take the risk, I guess, with you know, getting sick. And one of the things that has made the ICE agents so unnerving when you see them is they are all masked. They're all masked, and it looks like a street gang.
Right.
There's something disturbing about a bunch of men unloading from a black SUV who are all heavily masked. Their identities totally obscured, and they're all carrying weapons. And they start engaging in violence and grabbing people in the street and, you know, carrying people away. There's something about that image that leaves you shocked. The first time I saw it, I had to come home. I literally came home and I laid on the couch over there for about 2 hours and just sort of tried to process what I'd seen. And I think that if they were not masked, if they wore uniforms that looked more official, if they, you know, basically looked like employees of the government as opposed to a street gang, you know, maybe the public backlash would be lessened. So I think there's probably a lesson in that.
What other news items, other, you know, kind of people that are showing some heroism right now are the folks at work for the government. We had 8 additional federal prosecutors who are quitting the Minnesota U.S. Attorney's Office. According to the Minneapolis Star Tribune yesterday, there are 6 other prosecutors that already left, so it's 14. Basically, the short of this is that they are, you know, being asked by the government to use the power of the state to terrorize people like Rene Good's wife and others. And it's nice to see that like level of resistance and pushback as well. I don't know what else you're seeing on that front or otherwise.
It's hard to sort of even put into words the unanimity of opposition ICE in Minneapolis, especially, but really across the Twin Cities and a lot of Minnesota, I think, at this point. No one here really believes that what ICE is doing is immigration enforcement. If you were doing immigration enforcement, this is a horrendous way to do it because you require many men with guns and a lot of violence to even arrest one person. The overwhelmingly sense on the ground here is that this is a retributive campaign against our city and our state. And I think that has leaked through into the broader culture here. There's anti-ICE material on every street post, on every storefront, you know, every business. And I just think that, you know, you've seen it in even, you know, in places that are more ordinarily what I think would be more predisposed to be at least, you know, somewhat friendly. I mean, I think that, for instance, our police department, while there's a complicated politics within the police department, I can tell you from the ground that it's very obvious there is no love lost between the Minneapolis Police Department and ICE. You will be doing a rapid response observing ICE. You know, frankly, I've had a couple times I was following an ICE car and they try and get away from you by making a legal turn or running a red light. And it's like, I'm sorry, no, I'm not going to let you do that. So I'll just follow them right through. And, you know, there's a police car right there. They don't see anything.
They're not pulling you over.
They know what's happening. They're just letting me go. ICE is not making the jobs easier for the rest of law enforcement here in Minnesota.
We appreciate those guys looking the other way. All right, we're going to go rapid fire through a couple of your past internet controversies just to get updated on them. All right, are you ready? Your biggest one, I guess, was you're fighting a lot with people during the campaign in 24 about whether the economy is actually bad or whether we're in what you'd call a vibe session, whether people just felt like it was bad or wasn't that bad. I would say that argument split us at the Bulwark as well. My colleague JVL was, I think, more on your side of that case. I was kind of more on the other side of it, that the economy was annoying. Like, it wasn't a recession, but it was like really annoying for people. And it was like in people's faces how much they had to pay more and how quickly that happened. We're like a year away from that now. You know, the Trump economy is a little worse, right? But it's like kind of on a similar trajectory. I'm wondering how you feel about all of that now and what you think the current state of affairs is.
I definitely haven't changed my view on that. I think that Trump's economy is, like you say, it's worse. It definitely seems like it's on the downslip a little bit. But the amount of anger about Trump's economy is extraordinary. I mean, people really seem to think that we're experiencing severe inflation. And while certainly tariffs are a terrible policy and not helping, you know, inflation is not that high. I mean, it's much lower than it was during a lot of Biden's administration. I can't think of any reason that people would be so angry about 3% inflation or whatever beyond kind of this social media and media narrative that the economy is terrible. It just seems severely disconnected from what we're seeing on the ground. I expected whatever happened with Biden would essentially end with Trump, that Trump would take office and that the sort of aura of good economy that seems to surround a Republican presidency would suddenly attach to him and that everyone would think the economy is great. I was completely incorrect. People hate it. People are miserable. And so at this point, I really just don't see any other explanation than that there is just a deep-seated pessimism that is somehow leaking into the, you know, psychosphere.
So you're blaming the phones. You're blaming the phones, not inflation being annoying.
I think it's largely the phones. I think it's that we communicate all day on social media and media, and that what sells on social media, what gets clicks and retweets and shares is gloom and doom. No one's going to click something that says, oh, it looks okay. It looks pretty good. But if you say worst economy ever, no one can afford anything. No, absolutely nothing's affordable. Inflation's 50%. Everyone shares that. And that is what permeated, you know, all of our brains.
All right. This one is a little harder to explain for people who are not on the internet. So stick with me. But last year, Grok targeted you.
Oh, right.
Grok is Elon Musk's AI program inside of X. I guess this AI explained in detail how to break into your home, assault you, do other gross things to you.
Yep.
This happened after an update to Grok. So I think there's some theories about what was happening there exactly. Just explain that, and then I have an updated news item for you on it.
Yeah, I mean, essentially Elon Musk updated Grok to make it less woke. and immediately malfunctioned, started calling itself Mecca Hitler. I actually noticed initially it was making really egregious anti-Semitic comments, making comments about people's Jewish-sounding surnames. The far right asked it to essentially generate sexual assault fantasies about me. It did so enthusiastically, and then they just extended from there telling people how to break in my house, how to kill me, just very, very graphic material. And it has become, you know, kind of a fixture, unfortunately, in my public reputation, I guess, is that someone always comes in and starts talking about Grok and me, and it's pretty weird.
How'd you react to that in the moment? Did you call another lawyer? Did you call authorities?
I have spoken to some lawyers about it. Yeah. My example I've used is that there were safety restrictions on Grok. They were there for good reason. They knew why they had them. They took them off. It's like taking the seatbelts off a roller coaster. You knew someone was going to get tossed out, and I was the lucky one. But clearly, Elon Musk has just continued to be pretty reckless with Grok, given what it's going now.
Well, I'm rooting for a lawsuit. You should do what's best for you. There's a Grok news item today. This is from Faye Siddiqui at the Washington Post. I thought this was interesting. Elon Musk has pushed internally to get Grok to lean into NSFW, not safe for work content. Workers were told they'd be working with sexual material. They're advised to gauge new job candidates' comfort with doing so. Soon they were training Grok on lewd conversations and depictions of sexual violence. So that was happening internally. It's a new Washington Post story that seems kind of relevant to your backstory.
That does seem relevant. I'll have to think about that a little bit. I mean, it's honestly one of the things that I'm interested in here is it seems very clear that Grok's malfunctions are just directly flowing down from Elon Musk's severe personality defects. No reasonable product engineer or even company head would push for any of this, but Elon Musk believes himself untouchable and thinks that, you know, he can make this into his pet robot that will just do horrific things for his amusement.
You might even call it Mecca Musk.
That, yes.
Something to that effect. Here's the third one. It was even hard for me to follow.
More?
It's the Will Stancil show. This was propaganda. God. This was a person. This is a real story. Okay, for people who are listening who are like, what in the hell are you talking about? Like, this is going to feel like real. It's a Mad Libs of a dystopia. There was a person who worked in concessions at the Philadelphia Phillies Stadium. They were fired for their commitment to white identity politics. She created a cartoon about you that was neo-Nazi propaganda, essentially a white supremacist cartoon that then Musk, you know, obviously allowed to proliferate on his platform. It's particularly relevant just in kind of the bleak path of where we're going. And it just got a lot of views. And, you know, if somebody that doesn't have a lot of resources can use these AIs to so easily make, you know, white identity politics cartoons targeting, like, not really public figures, no offense, like very minor public figures, like that, that's pretty scary.
I'm a strange person to be a subject of a show. This actually kind of flows out of the Grok incident, and that I think it attracted a lot of attention to me from the far right, which found it very hilarious. And one of the things that happened is that they did create this cartoon show about me, the premise of which is just basically that I think I'm just the ultra liberal that is constantly being assaulted by Grok. And then periodically I transform into a neo-Nazi and, you know, brutalize somebody. It's very strange, but it's a little surreal. But it has gotten more of an audience you would expect. I think that, you know, Elon Musk has made jokes about it. It's gotten written up in The Spectator somehow by the Raw Nationalist, who's a prominent fascist. I think it really kind of goes to show how much of our politics now is just kind of this weird, I would describe it as almost like a digital dream space that, you know, random ideas and people like myself, who, again, I'm not a person of any particular public relevance, just kind of bubble up into the consciousness and then become these figures. And then, I mean, I would say that as the person who's subject to that, it's a really bizarre experience. I mean, you know, I just go about my day and then someone says, oh, there's someone created a cartoon episode about you. And I'm like, well, I guess I'll go watch that at some point and figure out what that's about. But I've got to go to work.
I guess that is, in some ways, that sort of ties us together to like the gap between that, like what is happening in this digital world and, you know, having AI create these kind of disgusting, like sort of fantasies and cartoons about you versus what is like happening in the community, like what you're seeing from neighbors helping other neighbors. It feels like at some point where you need to figure out a way to, like, you know, create some better connective tissue. And I don't know, maybe it's our kids will be able to figure that out because they'll be more digital natives.
It's strange. And I mean, I'll say my personal experience, I'm very involved in my community. I am the vice president of my neighborhood board. I'm chairing my DFL, my Democratic caucus tonight. I'm convening it. I am organizing that. You know, I know all my neighbors. I knock on the doors when I ran for office. I know all the business owners in my neighborhood. I'm out there just doing this for a rapid response. And then there's also the second half of my life. There's essentially kind of this fantasy version of me that exists on the far right. There's also kind of a fantasy version of me that exists on the far left. That's this, you know, reactionary, ultra-centrist, in maybe collaborating with the feds kind of guy. And at some point, it feels like they all have to collapse together a little bit. I live in constant fear that these internet versions of me will leak into my real life. And it seems like maybe that has even happened a little bit with the ICE rapid response, where there's been some hostility to me taking part. And it is difficult to know like what sort of the future holds for this, because it's not a particularly fun way to live. I mean, people sometimes say, oh, you know, everyone, you're in for the clout, but it's like, really, it'd be nice just to not have all of this happening.
Well, man, I appreciate you. I appreciate that you're out there doing this. I really wanted to have you on and talk to you about it. So thank you. I have to ask, since you're in Minnesota, since you're this, you know, you're in the politics, you're in the DFL, there's a Senate primary happening there. Angie Craig and Peggy Flanagan. I haven't followed it that closely. I don't really know Peggy Flanagan that well. In candor, I like Angie Craig. We have some disagreements on a couple policies, but I'm wondering what you make of that primary.
I have to say that I haven't paid that much attention to that. It's a little bit ways off and we got a lot going on.
Yeah.
I would say that my sense of it right now at this moment, and this could be totally incorrect, so don't hold against me if I'm wrong, sure, is that it's a tough moment for Angie Craig, simply because ICE is so predominant an issue here in Minnesota, and Peggy, I think, has been a bit more consistent in her opposition. You know, Angie has voted for things like the Locke and Riley Act that I think will be used against her. So I would have probably, if I had to give someone the advantage.
Some Calshi advice?
Yeah, it'd probably be Peggy. But honestly, like, I don't really know. And you know, they're both pretty strong candidates ultimately. And I think it could probably go either way.
Well, I appreciate you being out there in the streets, all right? We keep us posted as things are going off. And if there's anything we can do to help elevate it.
I want to say this also, but thanks for paying attention to Minnesota. It's really important what's happening here. And really keep us in mind. I mean, again, I'm just one guy. There are thousands of people out here doing this, and they are every day standing in the cold for hours, watching for ICE and trying to keep their neighbors safe. And so one of the things that's really been a problem here is there's this sense sometimes that the rest of the country has just forgotten about us. And so the attention paid to the sacrifices of the city, of this region, and my neighbors, it's just greatly appreciated. It really helps us, you know, like, keep hope alive right now. So,
all right, man. Well, that's easy for us. You're doing the hard work. We appreciate it. Thanks so much. Talk to you again soon. Everybody else, stick around. I got a couple things to get off my chest. All right, everybody. Before I get to my rant, I just want to shout out my friend Savannah Guthrie and her husband Mike. They're going through some really brutal stuff right now. I guess there is good reason to believe, according to the Pima County Sheriff in Arizona, that Savannah's mother, Nancy Guthrie, age 84, was abducted out of her house. She's disappeared. It happened over the weekend. They're asking for tips down there. So if you know anybody down in Pima County in Arizona, please make sure to have them reach out to the sheriff's department. And if not, just, you know, keep Savannah and her family in your prayers. I want to talk a little bit about the Texas Senate race on the Democratic side, because I'm going to lose my fucking mind about it. But before I do so, I'm going to take you on a little winding road. So I want to reflect a little bit on my conversation with Ta-Nehisi last week. I got to tell you, I love that dude. He is in good cheer. He's like the platonic ideal of a podcast guest for me. Like, when other people are like, what are you looking for in a podcast guest? I'm going to send them that convo. The first question I ask him, he responds with a question. You would think that would be rude, but opposite. That's actually great. That's how normal people talk. And what you're trying to do on a show like this is have conversations where you like get into challenging topics and learn about the other person's perspective. And sometimes to understand their perspective, you have to understand why they're asking something, right? The guy like makes me think, even when I disagree. I thought his point from the last show about like thinking back to the civil rights era and like the internal factions and, you know, how that gets sanded down over time. It was like super important perspective that, you know, I lose from time to time. I wish that Kamala Harris was president so I could have more conversations focused on big think stuff like that and less just focused on the latest atrocities. But unfortunately, that's not where we're at. One person emailed criticizing me about this, and I think it's a legit critique, and I want to explain my response to it in the context of the Texas Senate primary. When I was pushing back on Ta-Nehisi on various things, I was talking about how like there were some excesses of this period of the whatever you want to call it. I kind of hate calling it the Great Awakening, whatever you call it, the critical race theory, you know, this moment where a lot of these kind of issues came to the forefront. There were some excesses to it, in my opinion. And a person that you know, replied basically saying to me, hey, man, like you want to live in like a colorblind society that like isn't reality. And I don't actually like, and I think that's wrong. And I also think that there's just a lot of space between like the cliche, like I don't even see race, you know, like that nonsense, and a like racially essentialist worldview where like skin color is the central factor you look to in every social problem, right? And like there's a huge territory between those extremes. And by the way, I'm not saying that Ta-Nehisi's in the other extreme, and you know, I'm just saying that like there's a lot of different nuance in there and a lot of ways to kind of navigate all that. And I think that it's important to think about it. And you know, one way I think about this is like in the Hegelian view, right? There's like in any big social movement, there's a thesis, there's antithesis, and there's synthesis, right? And I think we're in this period now, we're trying to find like some synthesis. You know, like there was all this good stuff that I think came out of that period, like increased visibility. Like I always tell the story about like how awesome, like how lucky I am that like now, like for my kid, there's a lot of kids' books and kids' stories that like feature people that look like her, which like wouldn't have been true a generation ago. That's awesome. Like I think that representation matters. I think that having diversity of thought and experience matters. I think about that obviously a lot on this podcast. I try hard to have people that have different backgrounds, different perspectives, different ideologies, of course, different, you know, racial perspectives. Like as a white guy, like I don't want to have just white guys on. Now, white guys do love to podcast, I should say. So like the list of people pitching me is a lot of white guys. Maybe there's something structural about that we could learn about. But some of the structural issues, right? Like redlining. One of the other things Ta-Nehisi said last week that caught my ear was just, you know, the way in which like, yeah, sure, we desegregated the schools, kind of. Are the schools really desegregated in New Orleans? I don't know. Like, I think that there are real questions that are worth exploring on all that. I also think that there was just some bad stuff, right? Like, there were some of these are extreme examples, but there were examples of like resegregating classes, right? Where like you had race-based struggle sessions among kids. I don't think is the answer. Like, some of the worst stuff you saw out of the San Francisco School Board, fucking. Just go follow the news about what's happening in the San Francisco school district if you don't think that there's some potential drawbacks to the policies that were advanced during, you know, this kind of awakening and COVID period. Another thing I don't really like is using skin color as a pejorative just for white women. Like, I don't understand why the only group that we can attack their skin color and is white women. And I think that's very common right now. You see that on social media a lot. And I don't think we should do that. I'm not saying that like reverse racism is as bad as racism or anything, but like it's not great. I think we could stop that and move forward as a society and be just fine. And another bad thing I think is that I don't think we should be trying to stir up identitarian race wars when none exactly exist. And this takes us to the Texas Senate race. Here's this drama that was going on yesterday. There's this TikToker who says that in a private conversation, James Tallarico told her that when he got in the race, he thought he was running against a mediocre black man, but it turns out he's running against a very talented black woman. Did he really say that? I don't know. That seems like a very weird thing to say. I don't understand the context of the conversation. Maybe this person was like putting it in a worse light than it would have been in if she actually had a recording of the conversation, which she doesn't. But, you know, that happens. People on social media pop off. But the reaction to it then from the candidates, I thought was madness. First, I should have mentioned the aforementioned supposedly mediocre black man that he mentioned is Colin Allred. I love Colin Allred. Okay. Got to meet him a few times. Obviously, extremely talented person. Nice guy. for whatever reason, like, he had a reaction to this that was extremely disproportionate, I think, to what happened. And I want to just play for you a little bit of it.
I understand that James Tallarico had the temerity and the audacity to say to a black woman that he had signed up to run against a mediocre black man, meaning me, not a formidable, intelligent black woman, meaning Jasmine Crockett. Let me just break this down into a few segments here. First of all, let me just give you some free advice, James. If you want to compliment black women, just do it. Just do it. Don't do it while also tearing down a black man. Okay? We've seen that play before. We're sick and tired of it. We're tired of folks using praise for black women to mask criticism for black men. You are not saving religion for the Democratic Party or the left. We already had Senator, Reverend, Dr. Raphael Warnock for that. We don't need you. You're not saying anything unique. You're just saying it looking like you do.
So this is what I'm talking about like trying to find synthesis. It's like every sentence in that reply is like about race. It's like, I'm a black man. She's a black woman. He's a white guy. It's like he randomly brings up Raphael Warnock and you know, talks about how James Tallarico's only is getting attention because of how he looks. And he's saying the same thing that Raphael Warnock says, but I guess it's because he's a white guy that he's getting attention. Can we just show everybody a little grace here? Does anybody really think that like James Tallarico was like intentionally like trying to be racist and denigrate people? Like, there are a lot of fucking racists out there right now. We just talked about it with Will Stancil, and he has a cartoon targeting him by some white supremacist. Let's maybe focus on the racists. Not that we all can't live and learn and get better, but just in the political sense, like, these are allies, supposedly. This is an important Senate race. The Democrats want to take back the Senate. They need to win the Senate race. Why are we escalating this and making it into, like, again, this like identitarian war between factions within the parties? I don't get it. I want to come back to the Raphael Warnock part in a second, too. Then there's Crockett's reaction. Crockett puts out a statement. It begins, "It's unfortunate that at the start of Black History Month, this is what we're facing." It's like, then Tallarico puts out a statement. He talks about how he knows how hard it is to be a black person in America and how it's harder for Colin Allred. And I just, all that stuff may be true or whatever, but like, is this the message for Texas voters? This is a Texas primary. Donald Trump won Texas by double digits. Like, why are we doing this? What is, do we think this is helping anyone? Do we think this is helping the Democrats win in Texas to make this primary about this, about like racial tension between Jasmine Crockett and James Tallarico? Like, when you read all these people's statements, it sounds like they're in a racial studies symposium at Bowdoin. There is a place for racial studies symposiums at Bowdoin. It isn't a Texas Senate race, though. And like, the median Texas voter is a 60-year-old white guy that didn't go to college. A key swing demographic, which I talked to about Bobby Pulido last week, Hispanic voters that didn't go to college. What is the message for them? Who's talking to them? If you're running for Texas Senate, you got to have to think about those people in your mind. Not that you don't think about black people or college educated people or whatever, but like, your message needs to appeal to the people that you need to win. You should be talking about costs and how healthcare costs are going up and how housing costs are going up and how fucking Ken Paxton doesn't care about them and how he's a corrupt twat. That's what you should be talking about. How Donald Trump is screwing them over, how he let them down. Like, that's the stuff that you should be talking about. And they're playing right into the hands. You know what else? Who else put out a statement after all this? Tim Scott. Tim Scott put out a statement that said, "Something ain't white here, James Tallarico." Fuck you, Tim Scott. Like, now he's trying to play on this and try to stir up racial tensions between the candidates. Let's just be honest. Like, Tim Scott doesn't care about black and brown people. Like, if he did, he would have spoken up when brown people were being sent to a foreign concentration camp in El Salvador. He would have spoken up when the Trump administration went after black refugees in Ohio and said that they're eating dogs and cats. Like, he didn't do any of that. He's not doing that. He's just trying to stir up racial tensions in the Democratic primary, and the Democratic candidates are letting him. Like, this is all crazy. Like, you have to talk about things that voters care about. This isn't about, let me just use this as another example. This is also not about Jasmine. I would like for her to run a campaign that has a message for Texas voters. Right now, she doesn't have an issues page. It seems like all that she wants to talk about is drama between herself and Trump and herself and James Tallarico. There are a lot of strong Black women candidates out there. I don't know if you guys know this, but I just want to tell you about some of these other candidates. Juliana Stratton and Robin Kelly, they're both running for Dick Durbin's seat in Illinois. Does anybody even know they're running? How about Lauren Underwood? She's a congresswoman in Illinois that I love. She's great. Are people talking about her? Angela also Brooks, she's the new senator from Maryland. Lisa Blunt Rochester, she's the new senator from Delaware. All of these are Black women running in blue states as less polarizing candidates, not attacking other people within their party on like racialized grounds. Who doesn't like any of them? They're great. We mentioned Warnock earlier. Think about how Warnock ran. This is one example that Raphael Warnock I love. I was trying to get him on this show fucking, I don't know, a year and a half ago. And I couldn't get him to do it. And I was like, why? And I started searching for like the interviews he does and the profiles he does. The only profile I saw at the time, I'm sure he's had more since, was like in the Atlanta Business Journal or something like that. Raphael Warnock was in Minnesota this week talking about the ICE shootings, getting people, you know, into the streets and getting ICE out of the streets. Good on him for going to Minneapolis, talking about actual issues. He has an actual issues page on his website. He knows how to run in a swing state, and he's doing a great job. And so we need more people of every race on the Democratic side learning from Raphael Warnock and talking like him. Hopefully they're ripping him off because he knows how to win. All right? Like, that's good. Doing like Real Housewives of TikTok between the Real Housewives of Salt Lake and the Real Housewives of Houston. Like, that's not good. That's not helping anybody. Right? That's not how you win. Raphael Warnock knows how to actually win. So I'm begging everybody in this race. Learn from Mary Peltola. She's running in Alaska. And it's kind of, there is an element of identity politics to it. I should just say, not all identity politics is bad. She's running on fish, family, and freedom. That is about Alaskan identity. It's about issues that matter to people of Alaska that she is talking about. And if the Democrats are going to win back the Senate, they need to win in Alaska or Iowa or Kansas or Texas or Ohio. And right now, Sherrod Brown is running a race that is authentic to him and authentic to the people of Ohio. And Mary Peltola is doing that in Alaska. I've seen some decent things about the Iowa Senate candidates. We'll see how that shakes out. I've heard some good things about the person potentially running in Kansas. See how that shakes out. It's time to turn this around in Texas. I'm begging James Tallarico and Jasmine Crockett and their supporters to focus their campaign on Ken Paxton and John Cornyn and how much they fucking suck, and focus their campaign on having a message for Trump voters that are disappointed about the way Trump has managed the economy and how he only cares about himself and the Trump Kennedy Center and his crypto bag and the East Wing and how he doesn't give a fuck about Texas voters. How about contrasting with Trump by demonstrating that you actually care about Texas voters and they don't? You can criticize each other over issues, electability, that's fine. It's a campaign. But like doing this drama nonsense where, you know, everything is about James Tallarico being a white man and Jasmine Crockett being a Black woman, it's not helping anybody. It's not good. Nobody's learning from this. Nobody's growing. I think that both of those candidates would be much better for the average Texan of every race than fucking Ken Paxton would. And so make your case to those voters and stop with the bullshit. All right, there's my rant on the Texas Senate race. If you stuck around for that, you are also a sicko like me and David Plouffe. We'll be back tomorrow. Do we have a fun one tomorrow? Yeah, we've got a doubleheader tomorrow. It might be a little kooky. We'll see how it goes. All right, so we'll see y'all tomorrow. Peace. From here on after, I'll hit 'em with a Texas swagger. From here on after, I'll hit 'em with a Texas. The Bullworth Podcast is produced by Katie Cooper with audio engineering and editing by Jason Brown.